In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Bob Carlyle had had 2,400 miles and 72 days, excluding Sundays, to think about this moment of triumphal return. Now it was here, and there was hardly anybody there to welcome him. He'd had crowds flock to see him up and down the country, but here in Penzance, at the end of his journey from the west of Cornwall to the north of Scotland and back again, the streets were sadly empty. Timing, in wheelbarrow pedestrianism, as much as anything else, is crucial. And Bob Carlyle had failed to finish his journey at a good time. If he'd only managed to get to Land's End and then double back to Penzance on Saturday night, as he'd planned, then he would have found the place buzzing and thronged with people, waiting to honour his progress. But he hadn't managed to make up the mileage. And because he wasn't walking on Sundays, he'd trundled into town on Monday, 15 December 1879, when most of the townsfolk had better things to do. Luckily, if there was one thing that Carlyle knew, it was how to raise a hullabaloo in a provincial town. He'd done it for years as an agent in advance for the travelling circuses, and he'd learnt from a master of the art, the dwarf general, Tommy Dodd, who'd shown him how to march through towns, make a commotion to draw out the children underemployed, and whip up a frenzy for the arrival of the fair. So that's what he did, and soon he had a pack of Penzance boys lustily cheering him on as he strode through the streets pushing his wheelbarrow with its fluttering Union Jack. Word spread that the great pedestrian was finally back, and the hoped-for crowd did gather on the steps of the town hall. They provided a boisterous audience for Carlyle's victory speech. He allowed his logbooks, stamped by the postmasters at every town he'd visited up and down the country, to be passed round the assembled masses, as proof that he had indeed completed his feat of endurance. He saw that the reporter from the Cornishman newspaper was in the throng, so Carlyle knew that his speech would go beyond Penzance, and that gave him the platform to take aim at his rival, E.P. Weston.
"Why did I do this wheelbarrow walk, you ask? I wanted to show that what could be done under the stars and stripes could also be done under the Union Jack. I wish to prove that it is quite possible to complete a feat of endurance relying upon the generosity of the public rather than with the help of a backer. Though Mr. Weston had a bus to accompany him, I travelled only with a wheelbarrow. I owe a debt to many on my journey, but the greatest generosity I received was from the licensed victuallers of Scotland and England, both when I was a teetotaler and when taking stimulants."
The crowd cheered their hero. The newspaper man rushed to the office to file the story. And with that, Bob Carlyle's greatest escapade yet, the wheelbarrow walk that covered the length of Britain, was over. From History Extra, this is The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea, the amazing life of Bob Carlyle, Victorian sailor, showman, and sportsman extraordinaire. I'm David Musgrove, and I'd like to introduce you to Bob Carlyle. This is episode 4, The Celebrated Pedestrian. I've used the word pedestrian once or twice in this podcast series, with casual abandon, as if you're all quite acquainted with the meaning of the word in a Victorian sporting context. Just in case you need a reminder, I found an expert in the subject, Professor Dave Day, so I asked him to define pedestrianism for us.
I think when people hear the word pedestrianism, they automatically, and quite rightly, connect it to walking. But by the end of the 18th century, pedestrian had become a term for both runners and walkers in a sporting context. Essentially, we're talking here about the forerunner of modern track and field athletics. Now, these pedestrian events gradually moved to measured courses and running grounds, which promoted races from 80 yards to 10 miles, attracting large crowds between the 1830s and the 1870s.
Okay, let's head to 1879 and the story that I started this podcast series with. Carlyle was 30 years old. As you know, if you've been listening to the series so far, he's already sailed across the Atlantic several times and survived quite a few scary scrapes at sea. And he's voluntarily put himself in cages with wild beasts in various travelling circuses across the land. But for the last 12 months or so, he's settled down a bit, and he's been living with his wife in St Austell in Cornwall. He's been working as a painter, but he's been chafing for something better. As he says, St Austell was
small town to stay in, which was like being in prison. At least so I thought.
Then one fateful day in early January 1879, the great American pedestrian E.P. Weston strolled through the town on his 2,000-mile, 1,000-hours walk. And that's when Carlyle was inspired to down brushes and lace up his walking boots. Weston was undoubtedly an inspirational figure to many for his feats of walking endurance, and he captured media attention too. He was planning on walking every day, bar Sundays, so he actually only had 35.5 days to complete his 2,000 miles. He had some decent motivation though, because Sir John Astley, an MP and a very wealthy man with a keen interest in sport, had bet him £500 that he wouldn't manage it. That was a hell of a lot of money. It wasn't just about the cash and the fame, though. Weston also had one other aim in his long walk, to spread the word of temperance. Now, this seems like a timely moment to clarify what temperance actually meant in the Victorian period. I checked in with Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister, who was a temperance historian, and asked her to explain.
Well, actually, Dave, it's quite a complicated story.
Oh dear, we haven't got that much time.
But I'll try and be clear and brief.
Phew.
Originally, temperance, of course, meant moderation, and there have been concerns about people drinking at all levels of society, but especially working people, for hundreds of years. This probably surged in the 18th century when there was great concern about working classes drinking gin, and one of the political moves was to promote the sale of beer. By the early 19th century, by the 1830s, in fact, it was felt that gin was such a threat that beer should be promoted. So the government passed the Beer Act, which meant that almost anyone, as long as they were a householder, could brew and sell beer from their own premises for a very small fee. This, of course, meant that beer ran like water, possibly more than water. And in the first few months, and indeed weeks after that 1830 Beer Act, there was social chaos. Apparently 50 pubs or beer shops each day opened in Liverpool each day after the Act was passed. The Daily Telegraph sent a roving reporter to Blackburn, which they declared was the most drunken town in England, and men, women and children, some stripped to the waist, fought in the streets. This freely available beer, and obviously very cheap and no control over how strong it was, this proved that actually making beer cheap wasn't the solution. So the existing societies that had been recommending moderation began to think, well, maybe it's not working. And the idea of total abstinence arose in the 1830s as a result of the Beer Act. Now, there are various places that will lay claim to founding total abstinence, but the first group was in Preston in 1832. couple of chaps decided that they would abstain from alcohol completely. They took it to the local temperance society, and on the 1st of September 1832, seven men signed a total abstinence pledge in public. And it was very much a performance. That's one of the ways I think that the temperance movement did very well. It was very aware of publicity, and the early working men who founded and spread the word of total abstinence, they were great publicists. They used to go in carts to local towns and even travel down to London eventually with football rattles and bells and call everyone to hear the good news, because it was like a conversion experience. So that in about 10 years, when people used the word temperance, they actually meant total abstinence. And a word was invented for this in 1833 in that Preston Temperance Society, which was teetotalism. One of the people who'd come in, he was a big drinker, and he said, I'll be teetotally abstinent. And so teetotalism stuck. And at one time, by 1900, it was estimated that 10% of people, 10% of adults at least, in the country had signed the temperance pledge or promise not to drink and didn't drink.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I think it's useful that we've got that full definition of temperance and teetotalism, because they reel large in this episode. As Anne-Marie noted, temperance really kicked off in Britain in the 1830s in Preston, but it also had a parallel development in America. By the 1870s, celebrities and sports people were endorsing the movement, and E.P. Weston was one of them.
Weston was an advocate of the healthy mind in the healthy body. And in many of his public pronouncements, he talks about improving people's health, improving people's moral health through exercising, and talking about the physical man is not a brute delighting in the savage butchery of the prize ring. He was of the opinion that no drinker in the country could do what he could do. So this is the idea that physical excellence, and even, if you like, physical health, is a direct result of moral striving, which is perhaps not a message that we would agree with today, but it's a good positive message. It sells newspapers, doesn't it?
Weston certainly made an impression on Bob Carlyle as he swept through St. Austell in January. Didn't seem to take much tempting from his friend, the grocer J.M. Williams, to persuade Carlyle to try to emulate the American. And after Carlyle made that first foray into the business of long-distance walking to win the 5-shilling bet from his friend, the seafaring circus man, who was also clearly a gifted athlete, sniffed an opportunity to turn a profit off the coattails of the American. In short order, he was making money by walking long distances. He walked 1,000 miles in 3 weeks and 2 days on the turnpike roads of Cornwall, for which he got between £7 and £8, equivalent to perhaps a couple of months' wages for a skilled labourer. A write-up in the Cornishman newspaper noted that he was moving at about 10-minute per mile pace, which is more of a run than a walk. He'd do a marathon in around 4.5 hours at that rate, which isn't too shabby a time. Let's check in with the West Briton and Cornwall Advertiser. Their edition on Thursday, 3rd of April 1879, recorded the details of Carlyle's perambulation.
On Saturday evening, Carlyle, the Cornish Western, completed the task he had set himself of walking 1,000 miles. When he arrived at St. Austell on Saturday evening, having then completed the 1,000 miles, at 9:50 he appeared quite well and in good walking trim. The walk was undertaken to show what can be done, and he intends walking in the next match at Plymouth.
This next match at Plymouth was a 6-day event. This was something that was carried out in an arena with pedestrians competing against each other to see who could walk the furthest over that time period. The sort of race was all the rage. Carlyle did pretty well. He came third and got £5 for his troubles. This was no doubt welcome reward, as by now he had a wife and family to support. His son David had been born in 1877 and his daughter Margaret in 1879. So he needed the cash. You might think that these sort of multi-day distance challenges sound crazy, and I'd be tempted to agree with you, but it wasn't novel. There was a long tradition behind it. In the early part of the 19th century, there was a surge in people, both men and women, attempting and often completing 1,000-mile walks. Interest died down a bit during the middle years of the 19th century, but then things hotted up again. According to Dave Day, this was the last blast of the mania for running that had travelled throughout the 19th century.
Now, there was a brief revival of endurance walking later in the century when Sir John Astley inaugurated 5 transatlantic 6-day and 6-night marathon races, roused nationalistic fervour in America and England, and were witnessed by tens of thousands of individuals. They were called wobbles. Whether that was because of the way that the walkers walked and they seemed to be wobbling, I'm not sure.
Carlyle was not invited to compete for the prestigious Astley Belt, so he was obliged to make his own arrangements for a 6-day challenge. In July, he set off on Cornwall's roads, attempting 500 miles in 6 days in and around Penzance. The West Briton and Cornwall Advertiser reported on his attempt.
On Monday morning, at 20 minutes past 12 o'clock, Carlyle commenced his self-imposed task to cover 500 miles at Penzance within 6 days. With a small whip in his hand, after the style of Weston, a close-fitting jacket, scarlet cap and black tights, he presented quite a jaunty and fresh appearance at the start, and this he maintained for the first day.
So Carlyle was cutting quite a dash, and clearly trying to emulate Weston and hitch himself to the much more famous American's bandwagon. In the end, he only managed 450 miles on that walk. But his endeavours were well enough supported by the locals, and he received £15 for his efforts from patrons. Obviously encouraged by the efforts and rewards, he made a plan to hit the open road again, but with a far more ambitious idea of walking from Land's End in the west of Cornwall to John O'Groats at the far northern tip of Scotland and back. This wasn't a completely new idea. The American diplomat and journalist Elihu Burritt had walked from London to Land's End and from London to John O'Groats in 1863 and 1864. And the Warrington-based timber merchant brothers, John and Robert Naylor, had done the actual Land's End to John O'Groats walk in 1871. Carlyle, however, had a plan to add something extra to the endeavour, to create a self-made circus that would get people talking about him. That plan was a wheelbarrow. He was going to push one the length of the nation. He borrowed the novelty from America, as he admitted in an interview in December 1879.
After being at home for some little time, Carlyle, seeing a very gloomy winter before him, and having read of 2 Americans who had covered between New York and San Francisco with wheelbarrows, thought he might attempt it.
According to Dr. Bob Nicholson, expert on Victorian media, the wheelbarrow gave Carlyle that little bit of standout.
The Victorians really love novelty. They love something new, something distinctive. And you can sort of see showmen always grasping for that new thing, that thing that's going to make you stand out from the crowd. And certainly, yeah, there was an American guy named Potter, I think, who published A Wheelbarrow Across America in 1878. Carlyle does Land's End to John O'Groats the next year. So I reckon, you know, he's probably, okay, this guy has really made a big thing of pushing a wheelbarrow. And it's distinctive, isn't it? You know, if you see a pedestrian just walking through, maybe that's not too eye-catching. You see someone wheeling a barrow, and some of these guys, you know, had custom barrows made with all sorts of things painted on them. It would really stand out. And you see it in the headlines. When you search for Carlyle in newspaper archives, he's always like branded as the wheelbarrow pedestrian. And I think that's enough to make him stand out. He's not just another guy doing this walk. Oh, he's doing it with a wheelbarrow. And that seems to be enough just to give it that bit of novelty. I mean, to the point that in the 1880s, there seemed to be loads of these guys just, you know, buying at wheelbarrows and walking from one end of the country to the other. There's a whole craze for it. And Carlyle seems to have really done well out of the wheelbarrow pedestrianism. Those seem to be his most successful trips.
In September 1879, Carlyle and his wheelbarrow were ready to go. He was clearly in straitened financial circumstances, but he stated that the intention of the walk was not to make money. Apparently, he took no bet or wager on his ability to complete the endeavour, but rather was simply undertaking to show that he, a Scotsman, had as much endurance on the road as Americans. That at least is what he said a few weeks later when he was in Scotland, though he also seems to have rebadged himself as Cornish when it suited him too. This is all presumably to allow him to adopt the moniker the Cornish Western in opposition to his American counterpart. So why did he big up that American rivalry? Let's go back to Bob Nicholson, whose research interests also extend to 19th century Anglo-American relations.
Britain and America have a really interesting relationship towards the end of the 19th century. They're no longer enemies or bitter rivals like they perhaps were earlier on in the wake of the American Revolution. They're more like sort of feuding siblings, always trying to get a one-up on each other. And certainly at this time, there is a lot of talk about America being the coming power. The 20th century is going to belong to America. As early as, you know, the 1870s, people in Britain are starting to talk about that, that, whoa, you know, this new power is coming up. So there's a lot of interest in trying to test one another's strength, to try and figure out, you know, who's fastest, who's smartest, who's best, who produces the most stuff. And there are loads of these face-offs between athletes, boxers in particular. There are a lot of Anglo-American boxing matches. And people invest it with this greater national significance. It's not just two men fighting, it's a British man against an American. And this happens in all sorts of weird places. The strangest one I found was, I think, from the 1890s. And it was a contest between a butcher from America, I think from Chicago, and one from Sheffield, to see how quickly they could butcher three cows. And it was done in a stadium in front of thousands of people, you know, with people betting on it as if it was, you know, a great heavyweight boxing match. It just adds an extra dimension to it and, you know, a bit of national competition. So it wasn't driven by bitter hatred, you know, that you might have for a real, you know, an enemy you dislike, but somebody that you would really like to beat. And so I'm not surprised Carlyle was keen to try to frame his exploits in that way, to sort of see, you know, Weston, the great American pedestrian, really celebrated figure, hugely famous, to say, actually, you know what, we can do better. I think people would have really got behind him for that.
Whatever nationality Carlyle adopted, it was the means of locomotion that he began to be recognised for. It was as the wheelbarrow pedestrian that he was described in the papers. So what did he actually do? Well, this report from the South Wales Daily News gives the gist of things.
Mr. Robert Carlyle of St. Austell, who has undertaken to walk from Land's End to John O'Groats' house and back, arrived at Ross on Tuesday morning. His intention is to walk about 32 miles per day, Sundays excepted, and he wheels a light barrow in which he conveys his change of attire and a logbook, which he gets stamped by the post office officials in each town he passes through. He said he was determined to show that an Englishman and a teetotaler could bear fatigue as well as an American. Weston had his traps conveyed in a bus, in which he sometimes took refuge, but he, Carlyle, was wheeling his own luggage and had no chance of a lift on the road. He felt confident that an abstainer could bear a greater amount of fatigue than a man who drank intoxicants. After making the usual collection, the pedestrian trundled his barrow away on the high road to Hereford.
So, Carlyle, like E.P. Weston, appears to have started off as an athlete dedicated to temperance and teetotalism. This is a little bit surprising, given his previous documented troubles with alcohol. But presumably, he was trying to reform himself. As we'll see, things didn't work out quite as planned. But if Carlyle's aim was to make a name for himself and spread the word of his cause, he certainly did that. You can read a regular stream of reports and updates on his progress in the pages of Britain's provincial papers as he made his progress up towards John O'Groats. No doubt he was using the skills he'd learnt as an agent in advance in the circus, working the newspapermen to ensure they were kept abreast of his movements, as he was relying on publicity to ensure an audience to sustain and hopefully patronise him on his way.
Bob Carlyle seems to have really understood Victorian publicity. He knows what makes a good story. He knows how to get his name in the papers. And it seems like that was really crucial for him, particularly when he was a pedestrian going from town to town. He needed people to know he was coming. He needed them to know to be invested in that story about this great walk that he was on. And he seems to have been really canny at this, at knowing exactly the kind of story that would get papers talking about him.
That press relationship did backfire on him once, though, in Dingwall. The Edinburgh Evening News recorded on the 24th of October 1879 that he was the victim of a pedestrian hoax.
Having been announced that Carlyle, the pedestrian, would visit Dingwall on his walking tour, young men clubbed together last Thursday and borrowed a wheelbarrow, with which one of their number passed through the town in the evening and was followed by an immense crowd of people who cheered lustily. The next night, the real Carlyle appeared and was coolly received.
Cheeky scamps. It took Carlyle 24 walking days to get to the top of Scotland. He travelled some 950 miles, an average of about 40 miles a day, and he signed himself into the visitor book at John O'Groats Hotel on the 22nd of October 1879. 27 days, including Sundays, from leaving Land's End. All the time, of course, he was pushing that wheelbarrow. It's not completely clear where he slept, but this reference suggests that he probably took advantage of the hospitality of publicans on the way. This is from the John O'Groats Journal, from Thursday, 30 October 1879.
He had received much kindness from hotel keepers in his journeyings, while hardly that to which he thought he was entitled from abstainers, illustrating their principles in action.
There's some serious snark there. That dig at the generosity, or lack of, that he was receiving from those of a temperance persuasion explains the following change of tune about the value of alcohol in athletic endeavours, as reported in the Dundee Courier on Tuesday 16th December 1879, entitled An Anti-Teetotal Testimonial.
The latest testimony to the influence of stimulants upon the powers of endurance when taxed by extraordinary physical feats is that of Carlyle, the pedestrian. When he was in Bridgewater one morning, he had walked 2,208 miles, and in address to the crowd outside the Mansion House, he stated that, though he started on teetotal principles, he believed if he had adhered to them, he should have been teetotally starved. Whilst he was convinced that, on one hand, if he had drunk to excess he should not have been able to complete his task, he believed that drinking in moderation had been beneficial to him.
Everything in moderation, Bob. Everything in moderation. So Carlyle eventually arrived back at Land's End on Monday the 18th December, having walked 2,390 miles in 72 days, exclusive of Sundays. As I described at the top of this episode, he had to drum up a crowd in Penzance and then delivered a well-received speech that was pitched perfectly to denigrate his rival Weston, make a grudge match of Anglo-American rivalry, and big up the fortifying athletic powers of alcohol. It was red meat rhetoric for the masses. It's clear that Carlyle's big walk was very much an extension of his circus showmanship, not just an athletic endeavour. It was a performance. Back to John Wolfe.
Well, I suppose it's marginally harder to walk with a wheelbarrow than without one. But it's definitely part of a stunt. It's upping the ante. You know, it's about being more out there, which was, again, you know, a key feature of the circus. How could you outdo your rivals? Well, if you're going to walk long distances, why don't you walk with a wheelbarrow that seems to do the trick? Hats off to him. It seemed to attract a crowd.
Over the next few years, Carlyle engaged in numerous long-distance walking challenges, for money, some with wheelbarrow and some without. He was mostly based in southwest England, but his pedestrianism was interspersed between bouts of sailing, which involved him getting back up to Liverpool to take ship. He returned to pedestrianism with a vengeance in 1883. He set off from the Old Swan Hotel in Liverpool on 17th August on a walking tour of 2,020 miles, which he undertook to complete in 1,000 hours. The 20 miles on top of the 2,000 was important because E.P. Weston, who was still in Britain, had just attempted 2,000. The Liverpool Mercury of Friday 28th September that year records his success in this. Bob Carlyle, the long-distance walker, completed the unprecedented feat last night of walking 2,020 miles in 1,000 consecutive hours, or 20 miles more than Weston undertook to accomplish. So he's got one over E.P. Weston at last. This was, as Carlyle's autobiography records, his most successful walking venture, or at least the one where he was best supported financially. The crowds were certainly behind him too.
When I finished this walk, the marketplace, a square nearly 100 yards each way, was crowded with people eager to see me. I was carried shoulder high into Mr. Melling's Market Hotel. There were collections for me in the wagon works and at other places, and the theatre gave me two benefit nights, the receipts of which were £30. So far as I can calculate, my takings for the 6 nights and 4 days that the walk lasted amounted to nearly £70, this being the most successful walk I have ever had.
So he won money and he won fame. Carlyle tells us that he went to Liverpool and paid off all his debts, but mournfully adds that most part of the rest was wasted. One can only speculate on the cause of this wastage, but we can be confident that he's still drinking because his next walk, another massive challenge, was decidedly not conducted in the spirit of temperance. Let's turn to the Witness Examiner.
A week or two ago, it was reported over the country that E.P. Weston, a noted pedestrian, was about to commence a walk of 50 miles daily for 100 consecutive days, in addition to which he would deliver a lecture on tea versus beer each evening. Bob Carlyle publicly asked if he could accompany Weston on his tour as means of testing the relative abilities of the two men. Weston, however, evidently anxious about his honour, did not notice the challenge, or at any rate did not venture to reply to it. Determined not to be thus cast aside, Carlyle announces that he will, of his own accord, make an attempt to accomplish the feat. Not only will he walk 50 miles daily, but every evening he will give a public address. The walk is not being undertaken for any bet or wager, and Carlyle states that he will not walk as a teetotaler, but free to partake of stimulants.
And it's a case of tea versus beer. Weston for tea, Carlyle for beer. What's fascinating is that though Weston did indeed walk as a teetotaler, he had no qualms about taking other stimulants, namely chewing coca leaves, the source of cocaine. The historian Dr. Douglas Small has written about this and noted that a medical doctor who observed Weston in his walks wrote up his drug use in the British Medical Journal and commented that there was nothing nefarious about the use of coca under the present circumstances. Rather than decrying it, the doctor gave Weston's drug use his interested approval. So coca was okay, alcohol not okay. Other athletes followed Weston's lead by using the drugs, but I can see no evidence that Carlisle did. Perhaps he should have tried, as he failed in this 50-mile-per-day attempt and turned once more to circus work for the rest of the winter 1883-84. At that point, Carlisle wasn't the only challenger to Weston and his temperance. In March 1884, John Northcott, staff sergeant of the 3rd Gloucestershire Regiment, proposed to double it. He would walk 10,000 miles in 200 days, subject to military approval, with a limit of 10 glasses of bitter beer and 2 sherries per day. As far as I can see, the challenge was not carried out. Perhaps it didn't get the approval needed from the army. But the newspaper reports deemed that he would have been a credit to the British Army if he had been able to consume that much liquor and still walk 50 miles a day for 36 weeks. He would certainly have been a credit to the publicans. The next year, Carlisle was back. In the summer of 1884, he tried again to complete the 5,000-mile walk in 100 days. In fact, he stepped it up to 5,100 because, of course, he was trying to outdo Weston. By that point, Weston had completed his 5,000 miles, and it seems like Weston basically ignores Carlisle, which makes sense. Why give publicity to an opponent? In all the newspaper reports, it's clear that Carlisle was walking in the interests of the licensed victualers. Apparently, by early September, he had succeeded in this phenomenal walk, and he'd done it as a moderate drinker rather than an abstainer. It's an amazing achievement. If you can accept a small, humble brag from me, I've on occasion competed in 40 to 50 mile one-day running challenges. They're quite good fun on the day. The day after, though, they're not so much fun, when you consider the blisters, chafing, and incredibly sore muscles. The thought of repeating that sort of endeavour day after day for several months is frankly unconscionable. I tip my hat to Bob Carlisle, and indeed to Weston. What's odd, though, is that despite the magnitude of his achievements, Carlisle's autobiographies are pretty shy on this. His 1896 biography notes enigmatically that it was the most unfortunate walk he'd ever attempted, though does note that he made a living at it. His more open 1887 biography explains why, as he admits, it was a failure financially due to giving way once more to his old demon, drink. Maybe it wasn't a good idea for Bob Carlisle, a man who struggled to control his alcohol intake, to be in bed with the publicans on this walk, and no doubt handsomely supplied with the very substance that he couldn't resist. He says that he drinks excessively a lot, so much so that on one occasion he actually struck his wife, and that resulted in him being spoken to by the postmaster. Perhaps guilt or remorse for his actions explains why he doesn't really talk about this in his autobiography. But to his credit, Carlisle seeks help. He goes and speaks to people to find out what he can do, and he's advised to sign the Temperance Pledge, a public promise to abstain from alcohol. Let's check back in with temperance historian Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister.
I think it's more to do with Bob's personality and maybe his own propensity for addiction that kept him bouncing in and out of the temperance movement like the rubber ball. He knew he would find a welcome back there again and sign the pledge yet again and resolve to lead a good life yet again. Reading his autobiography, it's hard not to feel fond of him, isn't it? Because he's very frank about his own impulses and his own failures and his own motives. And there's a degree of self-awareness there, which is very engaging. And yes, he did lead a bit of a foolish life, but he acknowledges that most of it was his own fault rather than blaming other people.
Carlisle vacillated on temperance as much as he vacillated on other career choices. And in fact, it wasn't long before he'd called a halt on the long-distance walking in favour of another stint in the merchant fleet. It was, as it turned out, pretty poor timing. Next episode, we'll take a look at the high point of wheelbarrow pedestrianism. That was episode 4 of History Extras, The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea. If you'd like to know more about Victorian pedestrianism and you're a History Extra member, you can watch an extended bonus interview on the subject with Professor Dave Day. Go to historyextra.com/tiger-tamer-series to access that. This is a History Extra production, researched, written and hosted by me, David Musgrove. My colleagues Rhiannon Davis, Ellie Cawthorn, Eleanor Evans and Rob Attar improved the script. Dr. Bob Nicholson kindly gave it a read through, and the producer was Jack Bateman. My experts in this series are Professor Valerie Sanders, Dr. Bob Nicholson, Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister, Dr. Martin Wilcox, Dr. John Wolfe, and Professor Dave Day. Thanks also to Sarah Williams, editor of Who Do You Think You Are magazine, for her help with untangling the genealogy. I'm also grateful to Chris Godfrey Morell and Ken Bogle of Midlothian Council Library Service for helping to find the Black Collection in their archive. I owe thanks to Craig Statham, formerly of East Lothian Archives, and Hanita Ritchie in the John Gray Centre there, who helped me to track down some local records in East Lothian. Lisa D. Tommaso, librarian at the Murab Library in Penzance, and Linda Camage of the Penwith Local History Group were also generous with their time. The Museum of Cornish Life in Helston put me in touch with the wheelwright Terry Ansell, who helped me to understand more about Victorian wheelbarrows generally. Numerous other historians answered curious questions from me, including Dr. Richard Scully, Professor Nicholas Croson, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Dr. Vanessa Heggie. Finally, if you're interested in studying archive newspaper sources yourself, as a History Extra podcast listener, you can get a 10% discount on subscription to the British Newspaper Archive. Just go to britishnewspaperarchive.co.uk and use the code BNAHIST24 at checkout. And that offer is valid until 31 July 2024. We'll be right back.